The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, Expanse fans, welcome to episode 4 of The Churn, where we're breaking down episode 5 of The Expanse, Home. As always, if you're listening, please make sure you subscribe on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because we love you and we would give you 5 stars. I'm Cher Martinetti, and with me is...
Adam Swiderski.
And, of course, we're going to be joined by Ty and Daniel, a.k.a. James S.A. Corey, and we're going to break down this week's episode. And we will also be joined later by executive producer Mark Fergus. So we'll get a bunch of awesome questions answered about the making of the show. And this episode was, it gave me a lot of feels. It really did. I have to be honest, like I had goosebumps this week. I know I usually do a clever little spiel of a breakdown, but I kind of just want to get right into it because this was a very emotional episode. And I think following... Godspeed, especially, I feel like these are two things, like, you're going to go back and rewatch them and you're going to be going through it.
It's always interesting with a show like this where you've got multiple storylines going on at the same time. And usually in these episodes, we're bouncing back and forth and seeing different things develop. And this was very focused. We're at a crisis point.
Yeah.
You know, one event that everyone is focused on. I thought that made it really cool and really propulsive. I mean, there's so much suspense. There was a lot of pathos.
As always, the effects look absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. For TV. Wow, man.
I mean, the whole scene with Miller and Julie was so beautiful. Like that entire, with the protomolecule everywhere. And it was so emotional. Like, I don't want to feel feelings.
And it's interesting because as a book reader, we are now at the end of book one. 15 episodes in now, and we have reached the end of book one. So... I'm really excited to see where things go from here, too, because that, you know, we're kind of cycling, at least in the book, in the sense of the book story, we cycle up towards a new narrative arc a little bit,
mm-hmm.
With some threads that are carried over from book one, of course. So I'm really interested to see how that happens mid-season. You know, this is the type of thing that I would usually expect to happen
at the end of a
season.
Yeah.
And we're not even halfway through.
And I do notice that there's a good, you know, initially I always thought that like so many of the viewers are going to be book fans and they've read all the books.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm learning, especially like we've been doing the podcast for a few weeks now, which, you know, has been amazing. And I have to say, like, the fans of the show are just absolutely amazing fans. They are so into it and they're so like welcoming, which is great. They have like a nice little like community going. But there's a good portion of them that also haven't read the books. And they're like just as enthused as the book readers. And it's really like, I don't want to say cute because it sounds like I'm being demeaning or like, oh, patting them on the head. But it actually is very cute to watch like the book reader fans interact with the non-book reader fans and how they like, oh my God, wait till this thing happens. Or I don't know. It's cute.
Yeah. And
it's endearing to me.
I think we definitely got some good performances this week. It was great. I mean, we saw just about everybody except for Bobby and her Marines took a breather this episode. But, you know, we got to see some great high G faces from the Rossi crew. The stretching and the grunting. It was great.
Yeah.
And oh, my God. I mean, you can't talk about this episode without talking about Thomas Jane.
He's just Miller. Such a good job as Miller. He really has.
And this was his, you know, obviously, if you've seen the episode, you know, his swan song.
Yeah.
And a lot of focus on him this episode. And just he is just so good in that part. And so it's so interesting having seen the development of his character. And he even says it, you know, I'm a guy who didn't believe in anything and you made me believe, he says to Julie Mao at the end. And you see it. You see it in his face. You see it, you know, in his physical demeanor and the word, how he says what he's saying. It was really, really, I mean, this, you see
it
why.
It was emotional.
Yeah, you see why they went out and got Thomas Jane for this part.
I mean,
because he nailed it.
It was absolutely emotional. Like, I honestly did. I was, like, getting teared up during that entire scene. Because, of course, because you knew, like, that was it. And now I'm also interested to see, like, how the absence of his character is going
to
be felt.
Yes, it will
be
interesting to see how the absence of his character.
Yes.
I'm not going to say it. Like, it's so hard because having read all the books.
But I will say this, because I have seen the next episode. So I'm not going to spoil anything. But episode 6 is pretty awesome too. So it's like, oh, okay, because like now there's other cool shit that's happening that it doesn't lose. So for anybody that's listening, like, it's not going to lose any. Yeah. You're not losing anything in the show because there is so much going on. But like, I don't know. Let's bring Ty
and,
well,
and, I, and I will
this,
say one thing.
We're just talking
I do
like
want to say one
listening.
Thing because I do you know, spend a lot of time praising the show. I had a very interesting reaction to the end of this episode, which we talked about a little bit before we started. In that, we don't see the moment that Eros diverts for Venus at the end. We got this ticking clock. It's going to crash into Earth. We got this great emotional moment with Miller. I almost said with Thomas Jane and Julie Mao. That's how much I put those two together in my mind. But with Miller and Julie Mao. And then we see the aftermath of that moment. And it was an interesting storytelling device that struck me at first as a little like jarring.
Mm-hmm.
I was waiting for that. I was waiting for that moment of Eros has turned. Where is it going? Venus, you know, like, and everybody cheers or relaxes, or the Admiral Akbar at the end of Return of the Jedi, you know, sits back in his chair and breathes out that kind of moment. And it was interesting. I'm not saying I didn't like it, but it was just an interesting choice. So I'm very interested to hear from Ty and Daniel and Mark about that and
so then let's hear it.
And I'm gonna stop talking about them like they're not here because they're here.
Yeah. Hi guys.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello.
So what, like, do you wanna start with like addressing that ending or for the episode? Since Adam feels some kind of way about it?
I have feelings.
He has feelings.
Yeah.
I respect your feelings.
But he doesn't give a shit.
I think it takes a strong man to talk about his feelings like that in public. I admire you.
Yeah, you can't see
it. Especially when the feelings are so clearly wrong.
Yeah. That's brave.
I own my wrongness. And
I don't know. It kind of sounds like you just got owned. But
hey-o.
Again, thank you very much. Yeah. I'm here all week.
So tell me why my feelings are wrong. I'm totally open to hearing that.
Well, because that's not what they did, but
well, no, why? I said why.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, because that's not what they did. But I guess, yeah, what made you make the decision that you guys made for the ending not showing that part that he was expecting, or maybe readers would be expecting?
It's Miller's moment. It's, anything that pulled the moment away and made it someone else's moment felt like it lessened the impact of what was happening there. We really wanted the sort of end of that emotional arc to be about Miller in that room with his helmet off with Julie and facing the unknown, his existential unknown. I mean, that is what the moment is about, and cutting to outside and the asteroid zipping around and people like looking relieved into screens isn't that moment. It's something else. It makes that about everyone else other than them. And that was a very conscious decision to keep everything about those two people in that room. And then we come back as sort of a little coda with the people celebrating the fact that they won and, you know, the Rossi crew taking a drink and Shorey laying, you know, Vasrala laying on her roof, sort of seeing the glimmer of Eros as it goes by and doesn't hit the planet. So, you know, you get a little of that emotional payoff, but everything about what's happening on Eros needs to stay with Miller and Julie.
And the reason that you would cut away from that and show that moment is to tell everybody what happened, to make it would be a clarity issue. And I don't think any of the folks watching our show at this point didn't clock what happened.
Well,
I don't think that there was.
Because when the first shot after that is Vasrala on her roof, and in that moment, I didn't know. I mean, I know because I've read the books and I know what happens.
See,
but like,
I
did you register immediately that she was sitting? Because she could have very well been sitting on her roof waiting.
No, I
to
mean, I instantly
die.
Knew that. Like, I didn't feel like, oh my god, where did those missiles go? Like, who's gonna die? Like, I what I took from it was that crisis diverted.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, that's a, to me, it was as much a moment of, I thought we were going to, like, honestly see her on her roof. Like, she's laying there waiting to, for the impact.
Smoking a fatty.
Right. Okay. And then, obviously, and then, and then we would get that moment of, but it turned, you know, I don't know. But, and I totally hear what you guys are saying about making it moment. Well,
and,
that really, and makes
we kind of did the, oh my God, it turned thing like last week.
Yeah, that's exactly.
That is true too.
Yeah.
You should have that for every episode. Adam. We need one of those for every episode. We need something to turn at the last minute in every episode of the show.
This is why
forward.
You don't make
this is why I don't run a show
yeah.
about space.
So I want to talk about the effects, especially the beginning of the episode, especially that amazing scene with it was more than just a scene, but the entire beginning with Miller and Julie Mao. And first, let's talk about those effects, though, because yeah. the protomolecule looks absolutely beautiful.
I love so much how it builds.
Yeah.
Like, at first, you just got a little, you got the few dust motes, and then you see some outcroppings. And by the end, you're in full-on protomolecule fantasia.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really, really neat way to for the thing to be revealed.
Ty, I know that you were joking, but not joking, that you put the effects crew through hell with making a lot of this stuff. So how did this come together, like this scene?
This one actually, it got storyboarded a lot. There was a ton of conversation about this one right from the very beginning of pre-production. So this one, everybody knew really early on what it needed to be. We had great concept art for it that we had all over the office, even when we were still writing scripts. So this one didn't actually require a lot of back and forth. Bob Monroe and his crew, they knew what they needed to do right from the start and just made that. They just made the thing we had been designing and talking about for months at that point, and it's gorgeous.
Daniel, do you have any input? Do you have as much input when it comes to the effects as Ty?
Oh no, Ty definitely has more of an eye and an understanding of that than I did. The thing that amazed me being on set when we were doing this was how much of the protomolecule stuff was practical. That's not something that I've seen a whole lot of. And when we're going in at the end there, the early dailies of that, we almost didn't need to add VFX to it to make it feel the way that it does at the end.
And that's ultimately, I think, the fact that you guys do so many practical effects, which, having visited the set during the first season, I know how massive those sets are, and I've seen how detailed even the sets are. And I think the fact that you guys do so much practical stuff is going to help the show age really well. Because, you know, a lot of the times when things rely too much on, like, CGI or, like, After Effects, like, that stuff with technology as it passes, like, sometimes it's just looking a little hokey. But I'm actually surprised to hear that, too, because now I'm trying to imagine, like, how big a space that must have taken up. And I actually find myself thinking that a lot this season. Like, even last episode when they were, you know, when Miller and Diogo were on the were on Eros, I was wondering, like, okay, how much of this is actually their set? Because their set is ginormous.
Yeah. I actually had a question about the protomolecule effects, because in the book, I remember there being a couple moments of real, like, John Carpenter's The Thing body horror type stuff, where you saw hands crawling around on their own, or a rib cage. That was something that stuck in my mind that was doing something. And you do see the glowing kind of outcropping of a hand forming, but you don't get that kind of that body horror element as much out of this. And I hesitate to say horror, because it's not really a horror moment in the book, but that's just kind of what I think of it. You know, I think of John Carpenter's The Thing, where the head sprouts legs and is walking around.
Yeah.
What can you talk a bit about that, and whether that was a practical decision not to include that or to go in a more ethereal direction?
I can talk about why I wasn't there when that decision was made, sure. But I can tell you why I think it was the right one.
Okay, great.
The beautiful thing about John Carpenter's The Thing is that it is both viscerally horrific and kind of funny. I mean, when the guy is going to put the
defibrillators, right?
Defibrillators on it, yeah. And it bites him. that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I laughed. I mean, maybe it's just me. And that, I think that that body horror element could very easily have come off as a way to release the tension mm-hmm. in the moment. And I'm glad we didn't give people that that out. I'm glad we saved it up for the emotional moment at the end.
That's cool. Yeah, no, I was just curious because I didn't know if that was a, you know, oh, it's just practically difficult and not doesn't make sense to have a hand crawling around, or whether it was a more thematic decision, you know. So, yeah, that was my question.
Okay, well, conversation's over. Thanks, guys. It was good talking to you.
All right. Good.
So we have actually there's a couple questions that some of the Redditors had asked that I think that you guys could answer. So one of the things they first want to know is about Sam Rosenberg, if she's going to be a character, or is that character merged with Drummer? And something about, like, I guess that there was supposedly a different Sam that was cast for first season, but that wasn't the case. And do you want to hear?
I
researched that drama a little bit. That seemed like it spun out really quickly.
That was, there absolutely was a Sam Rosenberg in the first season. It was Ali Chung. And there was some confusion. There was some discussion on high levels on our end about whether we were introducing Sam too early, or whether we really wanted that character to be the canonical Sam or what. And it got confused. And the answer is that Sam Rosenberg does exist in the world. She is apparently played by Ali Chung. And many of the moments that we associated with her got kind of co-opted into the amalgam character that we're making with Drummer. Because Drummer was a character that came in book 5 mm-hmm. And is privy to some things and is capable of taking some actions we needed to have happen. And instead of just cluttering the cast list with more and more and more and more people to keep track of, we put them together into Drummer. And we see that in some other places in the show too. The other character who we're never going to see in the show is Soren from the books, who was Avasarala's second in command, who's her assistant. But what we needed that character to do, we don't need in the show. And what we do need can be done by somebody else. And that's why we're seeing Kotyar come up so early in season 2 compared to where he was in the books.
Another question they have is where I just lost it. They wanted to know about the dynamic of the Rossi crew. It's been more, someone said it mentioned that it feels more confrontational than it was in the books. So are you going to see them forming stronger ties? Are they going to start becoming more like a family, or is it kind of going to stay the way it's been going? That's something that a reader, you know, writer.
Now that's interesting because just I personally was feeling that vibe.
You
especially
are.
At the end, especially in this episode.
That they're more confrontational?
No, that they are more of a family. They're more on the same page. They're operating as a crew. Holden gives an order and Amos is like, yes, sir, you know, or not Amos, the other guy.
The other guy? Alex?
Thank you, Jesus.
Not a problem.
Yeah.
Jesus
I'm
is
on
not
all,
part
I'm
of
on
the
all the cold medicine in the world right now, so I apologize if I space once in a while. But
it's okay.
No, and Alex is just like, yes, sir. You know, they're working as a team. Amos chimes in, but he doesn't get pissed when his thing isn't fine. I got the vibe that they are kind of operating as a crew now. So it's interesting that other people have not necessarily gotten that as much.
How do you guys, what do you guys feel about that?
Well, I mean, we definitely start them in a different place. And that was a conscious decision that Noreen was pushing for right from the beginning, that if they start out and they're already best friends and they already know each other and everybody gets along, that it doesn't give us anywhere to go. And it's actually more fun to watch them become that group than to start with them already that group. So that's what we've been doing, and they're definitely moving in that direction. One of the big things that happens in the first season is this shift where Amos starts to see Holden as somebody that he can trust and rely on and is a good person. And in the second season, that's even being more exaggerated, that he's starting to see the places where he and Naomi don't necessarily agree, but now he does agree with Holden. And as the season goes on, you're going to see him also working through how he connects to Alex. So the great thing about Amos is that he's this sort of unchanging character, but through him, we get to explore all the other characters and their interrelationships and how they're all going to sort of come together to form a single unit. So, you know, I mean, it's very deliberate that we backed off on the cohesiveness of the novels, but it's giving us interesting places to go.
Speaking of the novels, somebody mentioned the game that you guys have coming out for WizKids. And they wanted to know if... sorry, I'm just now starting to laugh because I'm thinking about how when somebody tweeted at me that this game was happening and I didn't see the announcement for it. So I like tweeted it and I tagged, you know, Ty. And I was like, oh my God, have you seen this? He's like, duh, my name's on the press release. So I'm just...
He doesn't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and the love is just...
He just rubber stamps everything. He's just like, you know, whatever, sure.
So they wanted to know if there's any information about the new game and if you guys play tested it and what you guys think of it.
Well, I mean, I will be playtesting it. I'll be getting an early version here pretty soon. But yeah, I worked with WizKids. I worked with their lead designer. And by worked with, I shouldn't take too much credit. By worked with, I meant I had several phone calls with him where we discussed, you know, plot elements and story and things that would be fun in a game that makes sense in the Expanse universe. You know, I don't want to take any credit from them. They did all of the heavy lifting. They did all the hard design work. But I definitely consulted with them on what the game should look like. And I hope to play it soon.
Okay. So
I want to actually, though, talk about a bit, getting back to the episode a little bit, with the Thomas Jane in particular.
Go
you know,
it.
Obviously, this being
kind
his
of
episode.
All over the place.
No, and I want to hear from Ty and Daniel. I mean, like, when you were casting the part or thinking of who would play the part, how much was this particular episode, this scene, kind of in mind versus the hardened Miller we see at the beginning? And, you know, what did you guys feel about what Thomas Jane brought to what he did in this episode?
So I came into this not appreciating the brilliance that is Thomas Jane until we were well into the first season. We had a bunch of names of people who we were bouncing around, and you know, I'd seen Thomas Jane's stuff some, and I liked him fine, and I thought he would be a fine thing, and people were very excited about him. But going through from the beginning to the end and seeing how many of the decisions he made in like the very first part of the first season, like years ago, that were building up to what he was doing in this last moment. He's been thinking about this character more than anybody in the world except us, and maybe more than us. And it's, you know, I didn't understand how lucky we were when we got him, and I totally understand now how lucky we were when we got him.
Somebody actually said to me last night after the episode was done that they think that Miller's character is going to become one of those like very revered sci-fi characters, like a Starbuck or like a Worf, like one of those level of like an
this
icon.
Is, but this is after last night's episode, which was episode 4 of the show, so they haven't even seen the one we're talking about now.
Yeah.
It's gonna be,
I mean, I believe that the work he did in this show is certainly not going to hurt his reputation.
No.
Given that he was gonna die, did you ever consider Sean Bean for the role?
You know, actually, Thomas gets killed a lot too. Yeah, I've watched a ton of his various movies, and. I mean, he gets blown backwards with a shotgun in Boogie Nights, one of my favorite sequences in that whole movie.
I always forget that he's in that movie.
He's fantastic.
He's so
in that
good
movie.
In that movie. I love
and,
that movie.
And when he kicks open the door and Dr. Octopus from Spider-Man 2 blows him off his feet with a shotgun, that's not that uncommon in a Thomas Jane movie.
Yeah.
So that was key to his casting in this role.
It was based on Boogie Nights.
Well, in the casting requirements, it said must have been killed by Dr. Octopus at least once.
Right. And that's good. You knew what you wanted. Yeah. It's good to have that.
So what was, when you guys going back and watching Home, what was your favorite part of this episode this week? It's like a shared brain.
I agree with Adam that the sort of gradual build of the reveal of the weird is, and this, you know, a large part of this is the director who shot the episode, and then also Bob and his visual effects team. It was really masterfully done, that sort of slow, okay, here's some weird stuff, here's some fireflies, and they're flying around me, and now there's more of them. And I think it builds up to me, my absolute favorite moment of the visual effects is when Miller is in the pachinko parlor and his bomb has fallen over and he's trying to strap it back to his crappy little cart. And the UN has just launched its missiles. And there's that moment where all the fireflies are sort of buzzing around Miller and then they go really fast for a second and then freeze.
Yes. That was so cool.
And it's such none of it is explained. It's just a thing that happens, but everybody watching went, oh shit. It just feels so threatening. And all it is a bunch of little blue motes of light, doing whatever they're doing. It's a brilliant moment. I remember being on a call. I think Naren Shankar was the one who put out that maybe that was the way to handle that moment. And Bob's team did a fantastic job realizing it. And the director did a great job shooting it. It's one of those perfect moments.
Yeah. I think the bomb is kind of the credited star of the episode.
I was going to say that. Can we get a spinoff like Miller and the bomb?
Miller and the image of this guy, you know, dragging this heavy nuclear weapon through this, you know, weird, increasingly strange space on his crappy little cart. But the one moment that I remember being surprised by, remember being surprised by how important it turned out to be, how hard it landed, was that moment when it's Miller and Julie and the bomb is cycling up and you can see him going, should I just let it?
Yeah. One time when he did that I was like, is he going to touch it? Like, I was getting anxiety from that. I was like, is he going to do it or not?
That's a great moment. And again, that's all performance.
Yeah.
That's all Thomas. And he's doing it without saying a word. He's doing it with just his eyes. Yeah. You know, and the best actors can play a scene just with their eyes. And he's one of those guys. Just the way he looks at her and then he looks at the bomb and there's just that hesitation there. You absolutely can read his mind in that moment. You know exactly what he's thinking.
You see the whole and process it's a beautiful of moment. His decision. It's really, really neat.
I mean, I really can't, like, if this episode especially does not like put the show on the next like level, just with viewership and everything, then like I don't know what is wrong with people, because this is, no, I mean I'm not kidding. Like, this is really, like, I was thinking about this after I saw the episode, and I'm like, I can't really name many episodes of television in the past like couple years where I've literally had so many different feelings, and I knew it was gonna happen, but I still felt like that.
And I think that shot of Miller and Julie kissing at the end that we pull back, that is just, and again, part of it is the special effects and just those two actors and everything. It's just that should be like everybody's wallpaper going forward. It's just a beautiful, beautifully framed, beautifully executed shot. I thought it was very cool.
So, go ahead.
I wanted to ask if you guys caught, So one of the things that I was curious about leading up to this episode, because it was, you know, it was sort of subtly woven in, and we kind of leave it more ambiguous in the books, but we've made it a little less ambiguous in the show. And that is that moment where they meet finally face to face and he gets infected with the protomolecule fireflies that are like coming out of her body and going into his to infect him. that moment ripples forward and backward in time, that there are moments that we've been layering in for 15 episodes to sort of, they're like reverse time echoes of that moment.
Huh. I did not. Well, like, so I'm very curious to
yeah,
see
so
what that
let's
is.
Hear, yeah, let's hear, go
on. Down. So, well, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Dan.
The one that was the big one for me was when in episode 9 in season 1, Julie died, big quotes, and saw Miller walking into the room.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
so
a big one.
When she's in the that shower stall and fading out, mm-hmm. what she sees is Miller in his cop uniform with her necklace and the sparrow coming into the room. And we never explain it. It just happens. It's just
which
there.
Is, of course, a thing that never actually happened while she was alive.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. Wow. And we do see the sparrow again in
well, we see
the
sparrow the
climax of this
since
episode.
First season. Like right, that sparrow has been everywhere.
That was a neat little moment too, because yeah. you see that right before he walks
in. That
into
was cool.
Her,
that yeah. I did notice the second I saw the sparrow, and it's like I want to know, like, was there really a sparrow? Or was that a hallucination the entire time?
Well, but that's what we're going to leave a little ambiguous. But the other thing is that all of his visions of Julie and where Julie comes, when he tells Naomi. Julie comes, I wake up and she's by my bedside and she says, "You belong with me." Of course, that's the last thing she says to him before he gets right. sort of absorbed into the protomolecule. So he's hearing an echo of a thing that hasn't happened yet. So that means that all of his visions of her might also be echoes of this thing that hasn't happened yet. So it really just, I mean, the protomolecule is weird and the things that it does is weird, and that is one of my favorite weirdnesses, is this sort of ripples forward and backward through time from this one moment.
Now I have to go back and binge,
but that's
the
thing, and I was saying this to somebody that I feel, and I might have even said this on an earlier episode of The Churn, but this, I feel like once you watch this season, you go back and you're like, I have to rewatch now
yeah.
the entire first season, because it's like there's layers there that you don't realize mean something until you're like, something else happens in season 2, and then you're like, wait a second, like that just jogged like a memory and I have to go back and rewatch it. So,
and it's just so interesting with the show in this universe, you know, the protomolecule being the part that's most removed from our reality. I mean, I know we bend some rules of physics, but you guys tend to kind of lay into the science. With the protomolecule, all bets are off, you know, laws of physics being broken, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit about that as writers? Is it liberating? Is it something where you're like, great, we can do whatever we want? Or do you kind of take particular care with what you're going to have the protomolecule be able to do?
No, you have to be very careful with that. I mean, we have that payoff because we have this new set of constraints and rules. We do try to set up that it's not pure magic. It's still, you know, it heats up arrows, so it's still dealing with entropy. It's just doing things we don't understand. But if it gets to the place where people can manipulate it and it can just serve whatever the plot needs to have happen for the convenience of the writer, then we're boned.
Right. You don't want Deus Ex Protomolecule.
No.
And joining us now on the phone is Mark Fergus,
that
executive
so
producer
fake.
For the show. It's because I'm a fake human.
That's why I didn't want
to. I'm a life model decoy. It's fine.
Wow.
Hi, Mark.
Sorry. Hey, Cher. Hi. Cher, can we get somebody Hi. Good next time?
That's fine.
For once, it's not me yeah. getting picked on.
No, it's okay. I can take it. I was wrong about the thing at the end of the episode and wrong about this. It's okay.
Mark, thank you for making time to do this with us today.
Thank you.
So, we were talking a little bit earlier about like what our favorite parts of episode 5 are. What's your favorite part of the episode? Do you have a favorite part?
Yeah, but no, this one, as the guys know, this episode was a big one for us. It was sort of the reason we wanted to do the show was to not screw up what the book did in this episode, and certainly the last moments of Detective Miller. It was just really the bar was set to, if we could get that scene to work in the show, then, you know, then we'd have a show. So that scene certainly is was a big deal to us. And I think my favorite moment of it is, a line that Tom and I came up with like 2 seconds before the last take was shot. He just kind of wanted a line that goes bigger than Thomas usually likes to go. He said, you make a guy like me believe in something, you know. He just sort of wanted that moment and sort of fumbled on some words. And I think the way that sort of came out was so raw and beautiful and simple. And we didn't even loop that line because we couldn't duplicate the sort of the moment. So we just left it. It sounds a little helmety, but like you can hear the glass of his helmet, and I was like, no, let's just leave it. It's just got emotion. So that's my favorite single moment. Just that line that just kind of crept out because Thomas wanted it and was feeling it. Usually he likes to play stuff interior, but this time we tried to find some words for it.
Yeah. I mean, I think we pretty much all across the board feel like that.
That particular scene has been on everyone's favorite scene list.
Oh, cool.
You're like, yes, because I came up with that line.
No, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It was all me, people.
Well, he's a belter. He should be saying it in a helmet. That's fitting for a belter, right?
So wait, now,
So
speaking of belters, somebody actually asked, are we going to see any more Release Hall skinny belters like we saw in the beginning of season one?
I think wherever we can find them and afford them, right? I mean, they're hard to pull off on screen and not end up making your whole production, winding it all around, being able to find those people, being able to animate people who you want to stretch out. So I think we'll continue to do it in moments that really help tell the story. I think we've evolved the idea of what a belter is beyond the books a little, not because we think we're clever, but because we couldn't really figure out how to do it the way it is in the books, where everybody has a consistent kind of look. And it also let us kind of tell Miller a different way. He's sort of a poser. He wants to be an earther, but he's hiding that he's a belter. It allowed us to kind of go into those areas. So I think we should do more of it personally, because I loved it in the books. And I love when you kind of forget about it until you guys mention it in prose. You're like, oh yeah, he's a belter. His head is funny, or his shape is funny. Like you forget about it reading the characters until the books remind you that these are not normal humans in essence, or an evolution of humanity. So I would love to do more of it. So got to shake the couch cushions and find some cash for that.
You couldn't just CGI everyone's head like a half a size larger.
Remember, it would look like a Tim Burton movie.
Yeah, well, it was kind of terrifying when we were conceptualizing the show in the early days. It was like it's easy to write a crowd of 100 belters listens to angry belter ranting. They all have funny heads, and then you're like, how do you do that scene? There goes your whole budget, one scene. And I think we ran through every tall person in Canada. And we were going up to people on the streets going, hey, can you act? And they were like, because there's a lot of fantastic, super tall people in Toronto. So we were getting weird with people. And I feel like we had to come up with a better solution for this, for the show. And I kind of think we wove it into the story a little bit with the, extreme belter down to poser belter. It allowed us to do a lot of different stuff and worry about the actors rather than the way they looked.
Hey, Mark,
there is...
did Hawk ever tell you about the time he tried to hire the lady who was selling us towels to come be a belter? We were buying towels. We were rooming together. We were buying towels. And we went to a store, and the lady who was selling us the towels was like 6 feet tall or 6'1" or whatever. And Hawk started talking to her about being on the show. I think he scared her a little bit.
I know. And we're always like waving the wedding rings around. Like, no, we're not weirdos. We're not, some of the girls in the Lucky Bar, there was just so many tall, lithe, people who looked beltery, and it's a hard body type to find. And so we off as a bunch of creeps running around Toronto trying to get people to, you know, hey, no, this is a real show. I promise. You can look at it.
You can get the entire.
I swear but, I'm a
producer.
We
just stopped that at some point.
I've actually, like, dated a couple of guys that are
just
Canadian.
Got embarrassing. I've
dated a couple of guys that were Canadian, and they tend to be tall. So I feel like that wouldn't be a problem, like, finding tall. And, you know, Canada, yeah, they're super into working out.
You can just get the Toronto Raptors, the entire team, to cameo.
It definitely is. People look healthy up there, and they just seem to be, you know, yeah, they're just beautiful, tall people everywhere. And so, you know, we decided, let's funnel this through the casting directors. It's a little less creepy to do it through official channels. So I do think we should have more Belter in, because the Belter identity, which is really the most special thing about the world the guys have created, is the new type of human called a Belter. It is the greatest thing dramatically in the show, and the most opportunity. So we should definitely push that anywhere we can, because it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, one of the things that I saw people talking about in the subreddit was that it seems like there's been more Belter patois this season.
Yeah.
Is that something that you guys consciously did to push that out more?
I actually thought we did a lot less this year because we were freaking out. But maybe, I think there probably is as much, maybe more, but I think people are, they're kind of in the groove now. I think the first season, they're like, what, where are the subtitles? What are these people saying? I think people are, we kind of tune people to the rhythm of it. So when we do it, you know, it doesn't feel as jarring, or they feel like they understand the concept of it, which is, it's more, you need to understand the attitude behind the words and the actual words. So, I think it's probably, more accepted easily, when I think it might've thrown some people last year. So I think we definitely didn't, we tried to kind of find a balance.
They're,
we weren't,
they're,
you know,
super into it, though. It. Like, the fans are super into it, and they, like, want a book, and they're tweeting at me in Belter, and I'm like, I don't know what you're saying. Yeah. Like, yeah.
No, that's awesome.
It is.
That's super cool. And you know, when Jared Harris does his scenes, he wants more and more and more, you know, like, you know, the Belter speak, and the idea that, you know, I think it becomes a fun way to tell the story, because I love Dan and Ty's description of, you know, what, you know, the evolution, how this language came about, and why it's not consistent, and how it's supposed to be a hodgepodge with 5 million variations. It's such a fun way to tell the story, because you can change the whole meaning of the scene by adding or subtracting some Belter words, or putting inflection on them, or, you know, you realize, oh, this is how people, you know, keep other people out of conversations. This is how they judge each other. This is how they mess with each other. It's a really powerful tool for the story. So, I think we should do more of that as well, because it's so fun.
And we got,
and I love, and I still love no subtitles.
Nah. And we got the Belter middle finger this episode, right?
Yeah,
the Belter bird, such as it is.
Oh yes, yes. Is that Kara's or?
Yeah,
That was
him off.
Yeah, we were supposed to come up with a cool, you know, motion for her to do, like, in training class, like, they were going to come up with a Beltery thing. And she had that one all ready for, you know, on the day. She just did her own thing. And it was so cool. It was like, I'm glad we didn't get in her way and tell her to do something else. Because I think that one speaks volumes, you know. It's the kind of bird you can flip to your boss and not get fired. You know?
I think that's going to end up, like, picking up steam.
Yeah,
there
you go. It'll be a secret handshake for the fans.
But speaking of, like, I'm noticing that a lot of the I don't want to say, like, secondary, but they are secondary cast, are getting super, super, like, committed and into the culture of the show and the books. And Andrew, who plays Diogo, like, he puts out a word of the day. He gets super stoked. I love it. And the fans, I never thought Diogo was going to be, like, a fan favorite. He is a big time fan favorite.
He is a fan favorite.
I wanted to hate him. I wanted to hate him. Yeah. I was like, oh, this punk kid. And then I fell in love.
And Miller with the shit talking is, like, that's the greatest bromance ever.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
So cool. Well, Andrew's, like, you know, he's one of those guys who just, you know, he came in, he hit the ground running. He just ate that up. And, you know, Leviathan has Diogo as this sort of mentioned character. Like, you know, he just kind of comes in late at the Dalton, you know, it was, you know, one of the first conversations we had, you know, Jason Brown and it was like this, let's have this guy be a runner for like the entire show. Let's just like take this character and bring him all the way back to the beginning and turn him into a major character very gradually and try to see how a Belter kid grows up, you know, by showing his life. And so he's such a great kid.
I was going to ask a question. We talked earlier in this episode with Ty and Daniel about the fact that this is a major climactic episode. It's the end of book one, ostensibly, yeah. And it's in the middle of season two. So can you talk a bit about the decision, how you plotted this out and the decision to kind of get to this point in the middle of a season rather than trying to fit a season per book or anything like that?
Yeah, well, hell, that was our Hawk and my learning curve coming from features was, you know, that's an arena where you're constantly moving and cutting and throwing away and just getting, you know, getting something to fit the box. And so our intention was absolutely to do a book a season and to make that happen and to, you know, to end on the rhythm that the guys have written the books on, which is a giant game changing, holy shit, you know, twist at the end of every season, which we did anyway. But I think one of the things we learned in TV very quickly and certainly working with Naren Shankar, who knows TV better than anyone, it's stop racing through story. You can't go back and reclaim these beats and these stories and these character moments. You can't have them back if you blast past them. So, you know, trust the material and just let it fill up the long form storytelling canvas as it needs to be, that the story tells you what it needs. And so once we let go of that, it's like, it was weird to say, oh, we're not going to end season one on that moment. But, you know, we found a great substitute game changing moment, which was Eros. I mean, that's big enough to end a season on it. And the idea of, you know, thinking of it more as a streaming type show, eventually it will exist as a whole unit. 100-hour movie was our goal, you know, and it will exist in a linear fashion anyway. So tell it episodically, and then also tell it where people will see it in different forms over time. So it became less scary to sort of truncate this story in the middle and say, let's let it fill itself out. We would have had to lose so much great stuff if we were going to jam it into that box to just do, you know, 10 episodes, a whole book. We would have sacrificed a tremendous amount of great material along the way. And, you know, our sort of initial plan to stagger the books a little where they didn't, you know, where we were bringing huge elements forward into seasons where they didn't belong, or into the books where, you know, Avasarala's perspective, that was sort of something we wanted to do from day one. And if you start doing that, then you know, you're really going to be throwing tons of story out to make certain plot points hit at certain episodes. So we just relaxed the whole notion of that. And it just let the story tell you how many episodes it needs. That just became the defining thing. It was really hard for me to kind of deal with that at first until I realized, what is the problem? Just let it's one giant movie. Just let it be as long as it wants to be.
Yeah. I will say, as a fan of the books, when season one was wrapping up and I realized we weren't going to get to the end of Leviathan Wakes, I was so relieved because not saying, you know, I don't want to draw the Game of Thrones comparison, but that was I love Game of Thrones, the show, but as a book reader of Game of Thrones, of the Song of Ice and Fire series as well, that was one of the things I was like, man, this one season per book thing is really killing me because they have to brush through things so fast. So as that realization dawned on me watching the show, it was, I'll say, you know, for me, that was a really great thing.
Cool. Yeah. It was the hugely right call. We would have been racing through to plot points, and we wouldn't be incorporating the novellas. We wouldn't have been able to bring characters forward. It just would have been a mad dash for plot. And when plot is running the show, it's not a, you know, you usually suffer. I mean, we're going character first, and what is the big picture? Ty and Daniel have this vision for this entire series. We're considering it one story, tell it at the pace it wants to be told at, and not get artificial about how much story you want to jam into the box each episode or each season. So that is really liberating. It's such a different thing from what we're used to. And you got to love serial television for it is kind of this new form of telling the movie, but one story, but you can tell it over many hours and still have the impact of one story, which is important to us, that it's everything is still just the one tale. It's not, you know, hey, let's keep this interesting and make shit up because we got to keep this going. It's all everything should matter at the end of it, and looking back you should feel like everything mattered.
So do you feel, and I think, you know, Ty actually had to like dip out, so it's just Mark and Daniel still here. So do you feel that, Mark, that you, coming from a screenwriting background, and Daniel, do you feel that that's helping you guys keep so that there's such a character-rich story on screen? Like, 'cause I'm noticing that, like, you know, you also being a writer, your commitment to the actual books themselves and really making sure everything you're saying about, like, letting the story go where it's going to go and making the types of decisions, like, do you think that part of that is because of the fact that you are coming, you know, your background is as a screenwriter, and Daniel, do you feel like that helps with a lot of the decisions that get made for the show?
Well, I'm speaking as the guy who's writing the books. I feel like a lot of what Ty and I have done is kind of lay the groundwork and do the first draft that everybody else then gets to go and build from. I feel like we're doing the foundation work, and then they're building this cathedral on top of it, which is awesome. It's amazing watching the intelligence and the skills that Mark and Hawk and the room all bring to the story that we told once, and seeing what changes in the retelling.
Yeah, it is reinterpreting the material or bringing it to another medium. You know, there's a lot of that, but at the core of it, you the architecture, the DNA of the story, the foundation, the thing that makes it all work, when that's so solid that you don't break things when you move things around, when you play, when you say, hey, we're gonna make this character prominent and we're going to submerge this character, you move things around, it doesn't break because this foundation is so damn strong that you know, we've done a lot of adaptations. A lot of times you start an adaptation and you're going, okay, let's just break the entire thing down because this isn't a show, this isn't a movie. You got to start over and find the, you know, find the core of it and create a DNA for it. This is already like this book series, so much of that work was done by Ty and Daniel that we are just, we're taking it and trying to translate it to just a different medium, and to keep intact and to look for opportunities where they've written prose. There are opportunities in between things that we can dramatize. We can take way further. We can dial back. All this stuff depends on you're on really solid foundation. And that's why this has been such a blast, because we can spend our time, you know, in the translation rather than the, you know, the what the hell is the story? What is the character? Where does this go? How does this all fit together? That work is hugely done. So it's been a blast to adapt, because this is hard work, but it'd be a hell of a lot harder if you were still trying to lay those foundations. They're done. I mean, we all walk into that writer's room knowing the foundations are done, and we are just trying to build a nice, pretty cathedral, for lack of, you know, we're trying to make it nice, you know, because we know it's not going to sink into the quicksand. And that is a blast to do, because that is not how most adaptations go. You're usually figuring out what the thing is that you're telling.
Have there been any moments of particular friction between the world of from Ty and Daniel's imagination and the needs of the TV medium as you were going through adapting this?
I have a story. I have one story.
Right.
It was from season one. There's this wonderful moment in, I may have told the story. There's this wonderful moment in the first book that we kept. We had the little card with that moment on it, because everybody loved that moment, and we kept trying to find a place to put it. And every place we'd look to put it, it didn't quite fit. it'd be good, it'd be okay, but we already had something that kind of did that, and it bounced back and forth and back and forth, and eventually we wound up killing it. We ended up having this it's the moment when, in the book, Octavia Must tells Miller he's a joke. We never put that in the show because it didn't, even though it's a great moment, because it just didn't need it.
Yeah.
Is that hard for you, Daniel, to kill one of your babies like that?
No, I was the one saying they had to kill it.
Oh, there you go.
Well, have there been any moments that you've, like, and both of you, I think, can definitely answer this. Have there been any moments that, like, you're disappointed that you weren't able to make happen, that you wanted to be able to make happen and either couldn't do it just because it wasn't meshing right, or maybe because of, you know, budget restrictions?
I mean, for the most part, we save any moment we didn't get to do. We will find a way to do eventually. That's we make a running list of awesome things that for some reason didn't, you know, couldn't be afforded, didn't fit in. And we, you know, if the moment is great, it will find its way into the show sometime, someplace, because, you know, these types of moments, you know, that's a good story that Daniel told about, you know, the friction. I think from between us, it's been pretty, you know, we get each other as fellow writers, like what this job is. But then when you got to put it up on its feet and actors have to live and breathe and become this thing that you've written, that's where you find the challenge, where they're like, you know, that particular scene Dan's talking about is one that, you know, Miller was doing all that in the subtext. He was doing that all episode. He was living and breathing the self-loathing that she was dumping on his doorstep in that scene. And so it felt like it was going to be restating in words something that we were already feeling. And Thomas definitely, you know, in five, I mean, you know, he was making a big, he was having his Julie revelation that maybe Eros is conscious. Maybe Julie is in there. Maybe she's guiding this whole thing. And he came out, you know, he had read the script 80 times and he liked it. And on that day he came out and goes, "This scene is bullshit, man. It doesn't, it goes from zero to 100 in three lines." He goes, he gets this weird notion that the station's alive. And three lines later, he's saying, "Julie is steering the ship." He's like, "What the?" He goes, I can't make this work. This is just, I can fake it, but it's crap. It doesn't work." So we just sat there and the trailer and reworked it and played. And then at some point we just went out there on the, and I badly acted with him on the mic, just pretending I was Holden, feeding him all the questions that he was then. What he did was he took a bad scene and he said, "Let me just talk it out. I'm a detective looking at a few clues. I'm playing with evidence. I'm testing out theories out loud. I'm just saying, what if? And so now he has this mental process of figuring the Julie thing out loud. He's talking to Holden saying, "What if this? Wait, maybe that means this." And it became a scene, you know, by fumbling our way through it, just as Miller is fumbling through what might be happening on Eros. And it became a scene. But the friction comes when the writing is taking a huge shortcut and the actor says, "I can't transition from this to this to this. There's no, you're asking me to jump over a chasm here, and there's nothing bridging them at all." So that's where the most friction, I mean, you get great actors who think the material isn't taking care of them or isn't emotionally working, and then you just figure it out. And if it's a family and there's no ego about it and there's no friction, you figure it out, and it's a little bit of yelling and a little bit of, you know, but all to make a scene work. And so that was a really cool day. It was terrifying, but it was really fun to watch, to understand what he meant and why this scene wasn't working and what he needed it to be. And I love it on screen now because it is, you're listening to someone's thought process out loud, the way a cop would look at evidence and try to do something that might be going on. And so it turned from bad writing into a good scene.
So real talk, who's your favorite member of the cast? We won't tell.
No, <I'm kidding. laughs> Well, Thomas, because he can't kick my ass anymore because he's... it's been, you know, I think we just had, you know, a great, you know, I think acting and writing are are a hell of a lot closer than people think in terms of the skill set and the kind of being out there without a net. I think actors and writers get along pretty well because, you know, we both know the terror of the blank page, the unknown. You know, you're those guys have to go out there and flesh out moments and be honest and in the moment and have no idea if it's going to work. They just have to throw themselves headlong, and so it makes us want to be better writers. And I think we've been, you know, really, really blessed with our cast. And you know, I would say Thomas pushes you more than most people. He makes you be better, you know, like I was saying in that last story. It's like, you know, makes you find out what you really meant to say, regardless of what you thought you were saying on paper. And I think really great actors, they unlock the words like that. They change them. They kick their ass. They shake it upside down. They make you find out what you meant, and you don't always know what you meant.
And one of the things that was interesting, given the people, you know, we've talked to Dominique and Steven and Wes, the ownership that everybody takes of their characters. Like Steven went and talked to people who had worked with military personnel on the psychiatric end, and Wes went and talked to his therapist about Amos and what he had gone through. What was that experience like, seeing the cast kind of take ownership of those characters and develop a real intimacy with them?
And I want to add to that too, yeah. Though, like, and you know, Mark, considering some of the stuff that you've written, you know, you've had some pretty great actors, you know, making your words come to life. I mean, Clive Owen, you know, Children of Men, we can sit there and just have like an entire podcast just on that movie. So how do you compare what you see happening in the process on this TV show to, you know, some of the movies and some of the actors that you've worked with?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we weren't anywhere near the production on Children of Men. We had done our adaptation a couple of years before. So we watched in amazement as that story progressed and became this, you know, incredible movie. But definitely, you know, when you saw, you know, what we hope that, you know, Children of Men felt like, you know, it was our sort of retelling of Casablanca, or, you know, in the sense of a bad man redeems himself and does a good thing and has to get over a whole lot of personal pain in order to do something great for humanity. And that was completely intact. And, you know, we were very involved in on set in Iron Man, which was, you know, was a fantastic and brutal experience because, you know, we feel like we were trying to write a pop song and Robert Downey Jr. is a jazz musician. And, you know, there's a whole lot of figuring shit out. So there was just a tremendous amount of not, you know, having to let go of your ego and let these amazing actors find the words, find the scene, figure out what it means to them. And, you know, it often means a million times you're rewriting a scene. And sometimes you end up right back where you started, but you got to follow the process and get, you know, to a simple place where it's truthful for them. And it's fascinating to watch that. And we see that. And now, you know, being part of the show and as a producer and a showrunner and a writer and all that, you get to be there with a vengeance and see that process happening, and to watch, you know, Dom and Steven and you know, Wes and Kaz, and they're just owning these characters. They're finding them. They're making it really personal to them. And at some point you have to follow that ownership. It affects the writing. It affects how you're going to write them. Every episode they invest in a character, it changes the way you're going to write them going forward. So that has been a joy to watch, because I think I will take credit for being smart, is we choose good collaborators. We get into business with people who are awesome and who make us better, and that is I'd say, you know, tenfold for the cast. We pick really good people who are just telling us so much about these characters that we would usually be trying to tell them. They're telling you who, you know, I mean, Wes is telling you who Amos is to him. And that's such a tricky character, but you realize, I mean, he'll go through a script and he'll question lines that he's like, this isn't Amos. This isn't him. This is a guy trying to be snarky. Amos is just telling a simple truth. You're trying to make him have a line, a zinger, you know, like a funny, you know, moment, like during that fight with Miller, we chucked a lot of lines that felt like, you know, tough guy BS cliches. And Wes is like, that's not Amos. He doesn't say stuff for effect. He's saying stuff when he says, hey, Miller, stay down. And Miller gets up and he clocks him again and puts him down. He meant stay down. I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to break your neck. And we written it like he was playing the tough guy, like he was trying to be, you know, an alpha dog and dominate Miller. And that wasn't what it was. He was just like a child telling him, don't make me hurt you. Please don't get up. And that changes the whole scene. And that's because in the case of all the actors, but specifically Wes in that scene, they know what their character, what the truth of these people are now. And they help us to stay truthful.
I have one more really quick question for you, Mark. And then we do something called we shout out whatever thing that we're kind of into this week. But before we do that, I just want to know, do you ever look at the MCU and go, I started that? Because it really was Iron Man that, you know, if that movie did not work,
you know,
it was the first domino to fall. Come on.
Yeah. Come on. Yeah. No, that's, you know, I would have to, you know, obviously the love that people had for Robert was, you know, so hugely responsible for that. But I got to say that, you know, the Marvel universe is, you know, when I think of, I mean, it was all the producers we work with, Jeremy Latcham but you know, Kevin Feige, the sort of mastermind, the architect, the evil genius behind the whole thing, that guy, he's the guy. He knew 10 movies in on Iron Man 1. He knew 10 movies in where this universe was going, where they were going to interconnect. He's like the ultimate fan, and that's why he's so great at building these stories. So we loved being part of that. It was fantastic. But you gotta really look at who are the people who saw the big picture from day one, and you gotta give it to Kevin. I mean, he really is the, so we were thrilled to be part of, you know, to be a pencil for him for a while to articulate some of what he wanted to do with the Marvel Universe. And obviously it's been pretty successful.
Would you ever, write another like movie for the MCU? If asked?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I think it has to be like, you know, we kind of, you know, when the story kind of, you know, when there's an itch to scratch, there's something about the story that you kind of as a writer have to deal with in yourself. Then it gets really interesting. And yeah, we would definitely. I mean, it was a blast. It was, you know, again, it was early in their process, and you know, we got to be on set in a way that I don't think, you know, a lot of writers do. And you know, it was part of it was to be, you know, to figure out what this is going to be, this universe, this character, this franchise. And, you know, but you couldn't be, you know, we humbly, admit we were part of a much bigger thing, and we were being guided by people, with such passion for, that character and for that universe that you felt like you couldn't screw up in a way, because you were dealing with people who love the material. And I think that's when people love it that to that extent, you're covered. It's very similar to the books in The Expanse. We know that we are, we can play because we're in a really, really, safe, strong, story that we can play without feeling like we're going to fall off the edge of the earth, because we know that Ty and Daniel are building a really strong world. We're not going to, there's nothing we can, if we break something, we can fix it, because we know it's all covered. It's all coherent. It's all one big story.
Cool. I like that.
Very cool. Yeah.
So we're going to do our little shout out. So, like Mark, if you have something that you want to shout out that you're into right now.
Yeah. Are
like,
you geeking out about anything at the moment?
Is there anything?
Geeking out. I'm geeking out on a show that's not new anymore, but it's
it's in a good place.
It's called Top of the Lake, which I know that.
Oh yeah.
But it's you know, it's a great cop story, but it's Jane Campion, and it's you know, who has a storytelling voice kind of like nobody else. But this show finds a way to take Jane Campion and funnel it into a cop story, which is the ultimate, you know, genre kind of framework. But I mean, that thing is knocking my, it's amazing. So I just came to, I had heard about it. I had heard about it in the writer's room. I just kind of caught up with it. And that is some of the best TV I've seen ever, but certainly in recent memory.
What about you, Daniel?
I have kind of a deep cut this week. Back when David Bowie died, one of the things he left behind was a list of his 100 favorite books. And since then, as part of my ongoing mourning process, I've been picking up books off of that list to read. And so this is a not recent, but it's been an amazing few hours for me, was a book called The Age of American Unreason by a woman named Susan Jacoby. It's astounding. It is talking about intellectualism and anti-intellectualism in America from the beginning, and just drawing all of the lines through. And it feels like she finished writing it like yesterday.
I was going to have to say, she's going to have to add a few more chapters now, I think.
She kind of nailed it. She pretty much gave the framework that has made my life in the last year and a half make sense. So,
it's going to be required.
Do you have anything, Adam?
Well, I was just going to say, I still haven't listened to Black Star. It's been over a year, and I can't bring myself to do it.
You're fired.
No, I just it's an emotional thing. Like I'm really sad, and I just, knowing what that album is, I still can't listen to it.
So I know that we last week, or well, last episode, The Arrival, I was told to see it.
It's not The Arrival.
I know. I was told to see Arrival.
Yes.
I didn't like it. I couldn't get through it.
Now you're fired.
I am. But you're fired. But you know what I do like? What I think is the shit, Nocturnal Animals. That is way better than Arrival, I personally feel.
I don't know what that is.
Well, you are fired again. It's Tom Ford, who is literally everything he touches is art. Like, it's ridiculous how talented he is.
Is it a film or a show?
It's a film. Okay. Amy Adams was in it.
Wait, is it the one with Jake Gyllenhaal? Yep. Okay, yeah.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. And speaking about, earlier, we said how Thomas Jane is one of those actors, he could just use his eyes to convey something. What's his name? Is it who's the kid from Kick-Ass? What's the actor's name again? They just blanked out.
Oh,
super hot.
Who's in Godzilla?
Yeah, I didn't see that.
Yeah.
I just know he's super hot, and he was in Kick-Ass.
Aaron Taylor.
Yeah.
Johnson.
Okay. Yes. Aaron Taylor Johnson. There's a scene in this movie where his eyes, he's frightening. But this movie is so good. I think that trumps Arrival all day long.
You are incorrect, but that's
I'm not incorrect. You didn't even know this movie existed.
Your personal preference is wrong.
Listen, I'm never wrong. let's just establish that right now. Okay, so I mean, we're gonna wrap up
on that
this
note.
Week. We're gonna wrap up with me being right, and as always, you know, you can check out, if you haven't read the Expanse books, by the way, or if you have only read one of them, the full series and the novellas are all on Orbit Books, right? Which they can get on your website or on Amazon, or go to a small independent bookstore in your neighborhood that probably sells them, because we want to definitely keep independent bookstores in business.
Yeah, man.
So that, definitely do that. Definitely go to iTunes, subscribe, and give us 5 stars, because, you know, we love you. And
read the novellas too. The Churn.
Yes, read the novellas, especially the one that we stole the name of.
Yeah,
Phytolictus.
Yep. That's, you got to read the novellas too. They're as good as the novels.
Now, do you think that there's a certain order, or Daniel, you could also answer this, that people should be reading them in, or does it not matter?
Well, we read them in publishing order.
Okay, so then there you go.
Yeah,
such a smart ass.
Simple.
I'm glad you're picking up the slack for Ty, who had to duck out quietly.
I do what I can.
I know, that's why I love you. All right, so thank you guys for joining us, and thank you everybody who's listening, and we'll see you guys next week. As always, if you have any questions, you can reach out to us on Twitter at Sci-Fi Wire with the hashtag The Churn. And that's it. We'll see you guys next week.
All right, be seeing you.
Thank you.
Thank you.